And he noticed the change in me. You feel shame. Why? I did feel shame. I'd been exposed. What is wrong with me? Why does watching these clips fill me with happiness? Why do I laugh when I watch other people watch those clips for the first time? It's hard to describe, but when I press play, I know something is about to happen. It's like a chef who knows he's going to feed someone Japanese A5 Wagyu beef for the first time. There's really only two ways it can go, and both have holy shit in them. I want guests to either laugh or be vocally, physically uncomfortable. I've always had a visceral reaction to strange behavior. People who don't know how to behave in public settings are fascinating to me. And I don't think I'm alone in that. When someone starts yelling and cursing in a restaurant or store, we all turn our heads and watch the chaos unfold. I've also always laughed uncontrollably when someone tells me a story of personal injury. I know it sounds awful, and I presume it's a way of dealing with something uncomfortable that I never knew how to process. When I was a little kid, I would squirm at any gory details, and eventually, I would just laugh. I knew I was laughing a little too hard when I was working a construction job one summer in Florida, and I listened to a man tell a story about when he was injured. I was 18, and this was some brutal grunt work, remodeling apartments with no AC. My friend Steve and I worked under a guy in his 40s named Alan. Alan looked like he'd had somewhat of a rough life, rougher than ours, for sure. He was thin, tan, and polite, but he had that Florida man vibe. He'd probably drifted all over the state, maybe even the entire Southeast. Every morning we would arrive on site and he would take us through the tasks of the day. Painting, laying tile, hauling 2x4s. On one particularly hot day, Alan removed his shirt and I saw something I had never seen before. A foreign object was protruding from inside his abdominal area. It was clearly something mechanical in nature, and it was under his skin. What the fuck is that, dude? Oh, that's a morphine drip pouch. Huh? Alan went on to explain that the device I saw sticking out from his midsection was a port of morphine. It had a line from the port to his neck where it would release a timed dosage. I had never seen or heard of anything like that. And in over 20 years to this day, I've only heard one person mention a similar device. When I asked Alan why he needed a morphine drip in his neck, I was unprepared for his straightforward answer. A bathtub fell on my neck from a third floor window. To say that I laughed would not be truthful. I went into an uncontrollable fit of laughter that was so powerful, it rode on the verge of a seizure. My abs ached and tears poured down my face. I tried to hide it at first, but it was so overwhelming that there wasn't a point in trying to pretend it wasn't happening. When I finally recovered, I sat up and looked at Alan. He had almost the same deadpan expression on his face, but with a hint of a smirk. That's funny to you. I tried to explain then what I'm more capable of explaining now. It was the perfect storm of hilarity for me. It was the whole package. Alan's plain-faced expression, the unheard-of sewn-in opioid pouch, and the completely outrageous explanation that a fucking bathtub fell on his neck from three stories up. It's exactly what's so great about a perfectly executed joke. The information of the joke coupled with the timing. Alan got me that day. Thankfully, he wasn't offended. He actually grew to enjoy my laughter at his pain, and he would show up some days and walk up to me. I got one I think you'll like. Ever tell you about the time I broke both collarbones falling off a ladder? I would collapse over listening to every horrible detail. Fast forward 20 years, and I still find something so funny about injuries. I have to make a clear distinction. I don't want to see them. I don't like open wounds or gore of any kind, but an injury story or video of one without gruesome footage will make me laugh. I swear that I don't fully understand why it makes me laugh, but it does. One of our all-time most popular clips from YMH is captured from inside a car in Taiwan. The driver pulls into a mechanic shop, and the audio suggests that his car is manual, and he is definitely anything but an expert at driving it. He is revving the engine hard and struggling to gracefully bring it into the garage. Another man is standing there wearing dark coveralls and reading whatever is on his clipboard. He doesn't bother to look up until the car hits him. The clipboard goes flying and the man lets out an almost inhuman yell. Bakula! Ah! 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 He then yells commands in Mandarin, which we have since learned are the word stuck. The driver doesn't move the car for more than a beat, so it makes sense that the mechanic is telling him that he's stuck. Finally, the car inches forward, and the mechanic falls to the ground, moaning. The driver casually walks back, looks down at him with no expression on his face, and then just walks away. I'll interrupt my justification for laughing to inform you that the man who was hit by the car made a full recovery, not even a broken bone. It was widely reported in Taiwan, so if you're holding on for, yeah, but what happened to that man? Well, he's fine, okay? Back to the video. I would take the witness stand to defend my stance that this video is nothing short of hilarious. I've shown it to at least a dozen guests on our show, and I can happily report that a few agree. Some laugh just as hard as I did, and some look like their soul escaped when viewing it. I'm certain that it's funny, no doubt about it. But seriously, is something wrong with me? If you're listening to this, you probably made it through 2020, unless you're somehow listening to this hundreds of years from now. Nobody alive at this time can recall a year like 2020. There was a global pandemic, horrific humanitarian and economic consequences, unlike any that we could imagine. I was so lucky that I got into podcasting 10 years earlier and had built a fan base that wanted to consume what we were making. Everything was growing in that business, and it allowed us to thrive in the most depressing of years. I had made it almost through the entire year, not only unscathed, but prospering. Could this historically bad year go any better for me? It was December 1st, 2020, literally the first day of the last month of that terrible year. My good friend Bert Kreischer and I were going to film some content for the live streaming New Year's Eve podcast that we had planned. Bert and I do a weekly podcast called Two Bears, One Cave that has grown into one of the biggest comedy shows in the world. We'd done live streaming podcasts before, and we loved putting them together. We had competed on the previous one by playing tennis. I trained for months after having not played tennis for years. I got my forehand to a pretty good place. I was playing 3 days a week in anticipation of kicking my friend's ass. I knew he wasn't training as much as me. The only thing up in the air was how good was his game back in the day. We had established that we'd both played tennis as teens, but you never really know the extent to which somebody was good 25 years ago. There's one thing I can say about Bert is that he has a tendency for gross exaggerations. I was pretty confident that this was just another one of his tall tales. And he beat the shit out of me. 6'2", 6'1". It was demoralizing. My coach, Mike, whom I had worked with for months preparing for the match, was equally astounded. He actually pulled me aside and told me that Bert had a legit Division I college serve. He also pointed out he'd never seen such a discrepancy between someone's serve and the rest of their game, but it didn't matter. Bert's serve was so advanced, I didn't have a chance. I knew that on the next challenge, I had to show him up. I needed to pick a sport or challenge where I felt extremely confident that I could return the favor to my friend. I chose basketball. I actually played a lot of basketball earlier in my life. Pickup games, organized basketball, club basketball, and I always had a hoop in every house growing up. In college, I would go to the gym and get in on games with some pretty good players. After moving to LA, it was one of the first social activities I took part in. I would go to the Hollywood Y and get in on games there. Funny thing about saying the Hollywood Y is that people outside of Los Angeles think you mean the showbiz YMCA, as if there are red carpets and Botox treatments in the lobby and actors parading around in costumes. Angelenos know the truth. Hollywood means dirty, grimy, scrappy. Hollywood is easily one of the nastiest, most neglected parts of the city. It's filthy, and the pickup games are pretty good. I knew Bert didn't have the same basketball background as me. I chose this competition just to annihilate him. That day, we went to a private gym and were joined by YouTube sensation and exceptionally talented basketball player, Tristan Jass. He was a few weeks shy of his 21st birthday and had built an enormous following by posting videos of himself playing basketball against bigger, faster opponents, and not only holding his own, but often humiliating them. He also has an incredible ability to make trick shots that seem physically impossible. First, we played Tristan 2-on-1, meaning Tristan had to play against the two of us. It's completely unfair to play 2-on-1 in basketball, since the team with two players can pass to each other, and the other team can only guard one at a time. On top of that, we agreed that each basket that Bert and I scored would count as 2 points, while Tristan's baskets would count as one. He beat us. It was totally Bert's fault for missing a wide open layup, literally what fucking second graders can do. And we could have beat this kid. Big, fat, 385-pound Bert couldn't do. It was the combination of his terrible basketball skills and how absolutely enormously fat he was and continues to be as one of the world's fattest men. In case it isn't clear, Bert is fat and very bad at basketball. After the game, it was time for our pre-planned dunk contest. It was a simple plan. Lower the hoop to 7 feet 5 inches. Both of us attempt to dunk, and then incrementally raise the rim. Whoever can dunk on the highest height wins. We go back and forth until we get to 9 feet. This was honestly kind of the goal for my old ass. I was saying that I was certain I could do it, but I had a little doubt. So did some of the staff in my office. They placed bets. Bert went first. He came up just short and was certain he was done.
I can't do it.
This was my big chance. I wanted to win this, then play Bert 1-on-1 and redeem myself for losing at tennis. I lined up and boom, dunked on 9 feet. 41 years old and over 240 pounds. Truthfully, I was happy. Won the competition, and even my buddy Bert noted that it was seriously impressive. I felt good and was ready to move on, but then I heard it. Someone said, "I think you can go higher." I stopped. I really felt like 9 feet was close to my limit. I had a bit of room, so maybe what, 2-3 inches more? Now the pressure felt like it was on. They raised the hoop to 9'3". Roy, the man who worked at the gym and coached basketball, pulled me aside. He told me to dig deep on this attempt. I felt a surge of adrenaline. My heart started to race. I started at the three-point line and began the stutter step to get my footing right. I got closer and pushed off my left leg. Almost immediately, I heard and felt an explosion in that leg. It was quick and powerful, like a gunshot. I didn't know what happened. Did a car just hit me? I didn't know if I was 1 or 25 inches off the ground. I knew I was falling back. My left arm instinctively went behind my back. And as I hit the court, I felt the full impact on that arm. I knew immediately it was broken. I lay on my right side, writhing in pain, moaning. I tried to pull my left arm close to my chest, but it was spun around and facing the wrong way behind me. Bert got close and twisted my arm back into place. I knew I was super fucked, and I just blurted out, "Call 911. It wasn't long before it hit me. We were rolling multiple cameras. I'm going to be one of those videos I usually play. go ahead and look at your PDF and you can see ballin' ass young Tommy on the eighth grade B team at Lakeshore Middle School, Mequon, Wisconsin. And boy, was I ever. We have multiple angles of my patellar tendon rupturing, humerus breaking, and me groaning in pain. It's pain porn. To be clear, and I think this is an important distinction, my video is not the kind of video that I would have laughed hysterically at. I say that and people assume, oh, because you're the one getting hurt, so now it's not so funny. No, not at all. My criteria for what I involuntarily laugh at in these videos is pretty well documented. Sports injuries do not do it for me. They never have. I remember seeing Tim Crumry's leg break at Super Bowl 23, nauseating. Willis McGahee in the 2003 Fiesta Bowl, gross. Dak Prescott in 2020, Jesus, they're all awful. That is not to say that one shouldn't laugh at my injury. Many have, and I fully accept it. I'm just pointing out that I'm not being a hypocrite. But back to my video. Oh boy, did people love it. I knew it would get some views, but Jesus Christ, it took over my life in every way. Physically, I was completely incapable of doing the most menial task for almost a month. The double whammy of arm and leg being severely injured meant that even after surgery, I would need to be tended to by professionals to do everything. Eat, drink, sit, stand, and of course, wipe. I don't think there's a more undignified line that can come from your mouth than, "I'm done pooping. Can you wipe me?" To be fair, I met the most amazing nurses who only made me feel dignified and respected, but still. At 41, you don't imagine you'll actually need someone to wipe your shitty ass. One male nurse actually didn't want to do it, but let's forgive him. I wouldn't want to wipe my ass either if I saw me. I clearly remember the moment I went back to wiping myself. I had shit, called out that I was done, and a shift change had occurred between nurses. The older nurse left while I was still pushing, and the cute nurse took over. When she walked up to me as I sat on the toilet, I looked up and thought, no, I can't let her. The video of my injury is now unavoidable if you search my name on any platform. The footage was set to debut as a pay-per-view event on my ymhstudios.com site. It wasn't the only thing planned for the big New Year show, but clearly it was the main attraction. We knew people would want to see it and expected a solid turnout, but it far surpassed our expectations. My fans knew how I got hurt, but this gave them a chance to see it. So many people bought tickets that we crashed the streaming site, but it was after the show that the real show began. First, people posted the clip of my injury, then the memes, deepfakes, photoshops, even toy figurines took over. Yes, yours truly has a limited edition run of handmade minifigures of me, just what I dreamed of as a child, only these have me in the fetal position, grimacing and with a broken, twisted arm. The videos were posted and reposted thousands of times. I was the top GIF or JIF search, whichever version you like to say. I don't give a fuck what you like to say. I'm telling you, I was the top thing of that, of the moving thing. You got it. I was trending on social media and talked about by sports shows. At times, it was overwhelming. I literally couldn't get away from the footage or reactions to it. When the dust finally settled, I had to ask myself, had this experience changed me? There's no way I could sit here and tell you that it had not. It has changed me in so many ways, physically, mentally, and emotionally. It was a truly traumatic event. Those stay with you. Yes, you're able to continue living your life, but the scar, or in this case, the scars, they'll always be there. They'll serve as quiet reminders of what happened that day and how it was hopefully the beginning of a new you. So it begs the question, do I still laugh when I see a video of someone getting hurt? Absolutely. Save the word. This morning I was running late because I slept in. Not like in the old days before we had children. Back then, sleeping in meant sleeping into the afternoon. Those days are long gone. These days, sleeping in means anything past 7 a.m. My oldest son, Ellis, is 6. He likes staying up late and waking up early, the perfect recipe for ruining your day. He also wakes up ready for whatever, shot out of a cannon. He usually shouts, "Come smell my ass," first thing in the morning until you go to his room and greet him, or he'll run into our room, pull his pants down, bend over, spread his butt cheeks, and say, "I had a nightmare." Yeah, I think I'm looking at it. His younger brother, Julian, is 3. He'll change his sleep cycle every week, and you just have to adapt. One week, he'll sleep 12 hours and take no naps. The next week, he'll sleep 10 hours a night and take an hour nap after pre-K at home. Oh, and he'll nap in the car, and if you disturb that nap, you'll pay the price with your sanity, as he will cry and fight you for disturbing him. The next week, he's sleeping 8 hours a night with no naps. It's a ride. So today, I got up late because these two maniacs woke me up separately at different hours when I should have been sleeping. The older one, Ellis, came in at 1:30 in the morning to say he had peed in bed. I changed his pajamas, and then he said, "Come change my sheets." I tried to get him to sleep on a bath towel. "I don't like towels." Fine. I changed his sheets and basically woke all the way up to do so. Eventually, I went back to sleep. Next, the younger one, Julian, woke up crying. I pretended not to hear it so my wife would take care of him, and she did. That was at 3:30. Then at 5:30, he did it again, and since we take turns with them, she violently shook me and said the dreaded words, "Your turn." I rocked him, but it was too late or too early, however you want to see it. He was up. I felt like my eyes were bleeding. I got back in bed and then overslept. It felt like no time had passed, but it was almost 8 in the morning, and I needed to take Ellis to school. I had everything ready to go, his backpack, lunch, water bottle, keys, wallet, phone, but I was forgetting my most important accessory for leaving the house, sunglasses. I mean it. I'd rather not eat for a week than not have sunglasses. You see, Jesus loves me. I know this because he gave me blue eyes, blue like the heavens above. And yes, you might get lost staring into my dreamy, water-hued eyeballs, but you should know that they only despise one thing, bright lights. You, listening to this, probably don't have blue eyes, right? You probably have turd eyes. Brown, diarrhea-colored eyes are very common. I frown all day whenever I see them. Caca eyes, as they are referred to in the medical community, might look like shit when you see them, but the one and only upside of having those poop balls in your head is that they process light much more effectively. If I don't have sunglasses, my eyes actually hurt, and so does my head. I just want to lie down without them. So now I'm panicking. I'm running around trying to leave, but I have to have my sunglasses or else that bright morning sun will blind me. I stop at the door, exasperated. I know I'm leaving without them when I see my wife, who is late for work herself. "Hey, whatever it is, the answer is no. Please, no. I need your help. The kids are in the car. I'm not going to fuck you. No, not that. What? What is it? Have you seen my sunglasses?" She stops, looks dead into my perfect eyes, and then I note a telling smirk on her face. She knows something. She reached up and grabbed them off the top of my head and handed them to me. "I'm retarded," she agreed. "You are the most retarded, but I love you." Here you were thinking you were listening to a warm, relatable story about parenting. You're not. It's me complaining that I want to say words that some people have deemed unacceptable. Now, if you're saying, "Seriously, Tom, get with the times. The world evolves, and you need to evolve with it, you dinosaur," I agree. I really think we should all move forward, as there is no point in fighting change and progress. So I should make it clear that there aren't a series of words and phrases that I'm holding on to. It's really just one: retarded. Every year, the world changes in numerous ways. We've never seen change like we saw in 2020. Not in my lifetime, and from what I gather, the wave of protests and unrest are even more significant than what happened in 1968, when a devastating war and civil rights demonstrations dominated the psyche of the American public. One change that we're not always ready for is language. Words that once were the norm became antiquated and sometimes offensive. We as a society weigh the suggested substitute and act, or we don't. It used to be okay to say Oriental to describe a person from Asia. Sometime in recent years, that changed. Although the word is still used to describe objects such as rugs and businesses such as hotels, it is unacceptable to use it when describing a person. Most people have accepted that standard. You can tell it's really not an issue because you rarely hear the term Oriental in conversation when describing the person, unless the person you're talking to is over 80. And in that case, the person you're speaking with is about to die. That Oriental lady sure is pretty. Grandpa, that's your doctor, and you have Alzheimer's. If people really wanted to say Oriental when describing an Asian person, you'd hear arguments for it all the time. Your friends would constantly bring it up. I just don't get why she's so upset. She was Oriental, and a lot of them do that for tips. What's the problem? But you never hear that. No one complains because no one is married to saying that. The adjustment period is over, if there ever was one. Retarded is different. Not only is the history of the word different, the current day hypocrisy around it is astounding. People say retarded online and in conversation because we reject the notion that the term is outdated. What is true is that proclaiming that the word is not acceptable is in vogue. People will rant and rave, as they have to me, that we cannot say it, as it hurts those with developmental disabilities, even though it is widely accepted to have a second and much more popular definition. Do you believe the Sandy Hook shooting was fake and the U.S. didn't really land on the moon in 1969? Have you responded to an email asking you to verify your personal information or password without questioning who sent it? Do you expel infinite energy and time engaging strangers online in tweets or posts about sports, politics, or culture when you could be hugging your kids, eating a croissant, making love to your partner? Do you freak out and curse when you can't find your sunglasses, only to discover they're on your head? Well, in each of those cases, you were being retarded. I don't like the word retarded. I love it. I think it's my absolute favorite word in the English language. It's perfect. I understand that a lot of people don't like it, but I also understand that those people are the worst. Let's be honest. Most of them are retarded. Not literally, of course, and that seems to be where at least part of the issue lies. You say retarded and people think you mean mentally retarded. Mentally retarded is a medical term from the early 20th century. At the time, it was used to describe those with developmental disabilities. Naturally, the term could be used to insult someone who had done or said something foolish. But over the next 100 years, it evolved to have a second, more widely used definition. That definition is essentially silly, preposterous, or thoughtless. It's said without malice or venom, and it's said by millions, even those who lecture you not to say it. I know this from firsthand experience. I've had very well-meaning friends and associates sit me down and explain how hurtful it is to use a word that is so damaging when they can think of so many other words that summarize what I want to say without saying it. These lectures would give me pause as I wondered what I should start saying to replace the perfect word. And then, as if the Lord had sent the message himself, days and sometimes weeks later, the person and I will be having a conversation about life. In one case, about a party this person had been to. And then, boom, they dropped it without thinking. Todd went on a run and brought back bottles of beer in a paper bag. And when he got back, he leaned over the balcony to drop them down to me. He dropped 60 bottles of beer from a balcony. Why would he do that? He's retarded. I didn't get mad. I didn't even call him out. He was right. That's exactly how I would describe Todd, too. It should be noted that this is different than calling someone a retard. That has a lot more sting to it. And when you say that to someone, you're just being mean. I'm not telling you when not to be mean, but if you thought you could grab a piping hot cast iron skillet with a paper towel, well, you know what you are. The word is perfect. Not just for me, for you too. If you're someone who only thinks that the word is pejorative, cruel, and meant to attack those who cannot defend themselves, I would urge you to reconsider. Might you familiarize yourself with my good friend, Bert Kreischer? He co-hosts the podcast Two Bears, One Cave with me. It's a weekly podcast where we sit around, talk shit, and laugh. But if you really want to break it down, it's basically Bert regurgitating an endless stream of words that are tethered together only by the fact that he's saying them. He switches topics faster than he finishes beers. He typically will run through half a dozen brews in an hour. My role is trying to make sense of it, any of it. Bert is one of a kind. He bathes in his swimming pool. This is a grown man that brings shampoo into his pool when it's time to shower. He runs 3 to 5 miles a day, 5 days a week, on a treadmill. But he doesn't just run them, he drinks a box of wine while he runs. He cuts his toenails and tapes them to the underside of his living room coffee table. Do I need to go on? He's a great guy and one of the best friends you could ask for. He's loyal, genuine, and absolutely hilarious. If you asked me to describe him, I'd tell you all those things I listed and more. I love him with all my heart. But truthfully, and I mean this from my heart, if I were to describe him, I'd have to include another word. Retarded. Mike Tyson.
Good afternoon. This is American Airlines 1704. We will be departing LAX to Pittsburgh here momentarily. A little bit of traffic on the tarmac today. It is 2:17 p.m. Sit back or sit up. Just don't stand.
It's one thing to meet a celebrity. It's entirely another to meet an icon. Someone so famous that people from all walks of life, all ages and ethnicities, seem to lose their sense of how to behave like normal humans when they encounter them. I witnessed this personally the day I flew from Los Angeles to Pittsburgh on the same flight as Mike Tyson. Young passengers stopped in the aisle. "No shit! I love The Hangover!" An older lady making her way to her seat simply paused as her mouth hung open, speechless. And a lot of dudes bowed down to the ultimate alpha male. "Hey, champ, you're the man, Mike." The guys raised their fists, acknowledging that they know Mike's fist is the fist. Tyson's assistant, Rashad, once told me that when they visited China, one of the most strict, regimented countries on the planet, even the customs agents at the airport all left their post to grab a photo with him. Customs agents in China are probably the last people on earth, I would guess, to be swayed by celebrities. But this is Mike Tyson. He's lived a life that most of us can't even conceive of. And most of it has been in front of our eyes. Triumph, defeat, tragedy, comedy, hope, and despair, all wrapped up in a pit bull's body with an unmistakable lisp. You might have noticed that I mentioned talking to Tyson's assistant, and you're probably wondering how that came to be. Well, I, like all the other passengers, was fascinated by the champ's presence, and I couldn't help myself. More on that soon. The first time I heard his name, I was 6 or 7 years old. I don't remember which fight it was. I just remember my dad complaining that this guy kept knocking people out in the first round, and my dad was pissed that it was over so quickly. Shit, there goes $50. What was that, 20 seconds? I thought it was awesome, but it wasn't my money spent on the pay-per-view. I didn't really understand why my dad wasn't happy to have the fight end after 1 minute. I thought this dude was like a character that had popped out of a comic book, a superhero among us mere mortals on Earth. I mean, he sure looked like one. Mike was compact and muscular. His torso looked like it was chiseled from stone. He had the most menacing eyes on his way to the ring. But hey, he wasn't mad at me, so I loved watching him terrify other people. Later, I learned he was called Iron Mike Tyson, a.k.a. the baddest man on the planet. To me, he looked like the baddest man on any planet. You think anyone on Mars wants a piece of Mike? I don't think so. I followed the epic saga that is his life with devoted interest, like when a new season of Ozark drops on Netflix. So the last thing I imagine is that I would someday have the opportunity to meet this global icon. I shouldn't have ever met him. When I say I should never have met him, I really mean it. I was supposed to sit in coach that day, but I was upgraded last minute at the gate. I boarded with the first few people, and at the time, it didn't seem unlike the thousands of other flights I've boarded. People are tired. Most are dressed casually, which is a nice way of saying terribly. People used to wear suits to fly. Now it looks like they're picking up a sixer at 7-Eleven before they get back to their bonfire on the beach, wearing flip-flops and tank tops. You see the sensible business traveler, always wearing a shirt tucked in with a monogrammed luggage tags, letting people know I fly a lot. I watched this normal parade of passengers walk past me, and then I saw him. I looked up, then down, but my head shot back up, realizing what my eyes had just seen. Mike Tyson walked right past me and sat one row behind me across the aisle in the aisle seat. At the time, I was in the window seat, and there was another guy in my row seated in the aisle. The row in front of us was completely empty, so I suggested the aisle guy move up so we could each have a row to ourselves. This was admittedly completely calculated on my part. I wanted to sit that much closer to Mike and increase the possibility of talking to him. The guy sitting next to me never noticed. He was a total Justin. Over the next hour, I plotted how I would approach him. I had listened to the two old boners behind me force conversation with him, and it was excruciating. One of them asked him if he remembered one of his championship fights, because this man also remembered it. I was fuming quietly at what douchebags these guys were. The other offered him lunch the next day at his restaurant. I thought long and hard and decided I wouldn't try to be cool. I'd just be sincere and possibly humiliated. I reached into my bag and pulled out a shrink-wrapped DVD of my first special, Completely Normal. The plan was to pass it off like a mixtape. I got myself together, stood up, and I slowly took the few steps back to Mike. He looked up at me, and I have to admit, I was really nervous. Do you remember asking the girl you thought was pretty to dance in middle school? Your heart races, your throat dries out, and you stammer through the words. It's a terrifying experience. This was like that, only this time the pretty girl was known as the baddest man on the planet, and he could use his fists to kill you if he didn't want to dance. Still, I tried to remain composed as my voice cracked a bit and my mind wondered if I was upsetting him by talking to him. "Hey, Mike, I'm a big fan. My name's Tom Segura and I'm a comedian. This is a DVD of my special." I presented my DVD to him, still shrink-wrapped. He took it and, much to my surprise, actually looked at it for a moment. Then he looked at me and began speaking.
"You a comedian?"
"Yeah. I'm going to Pittsburgh to do shows. What about you?"
"I'm going to promote a fight."
"Oh, cool."
"I hate fights."
"Oh." I wasn't sure how to respond or what he meant, but he elaborated.
"Fighting is so chaotic and it brings up so many emotions in me. I'd rather avoid it, but I gotta pay the bills."
One of my favorite things about Mike over the years is witnessing how self-aware, introspective, and philosophical he'd become. Here I was getting my own little display of this, and I was loving every second of it.
"Where's the show?"
"Oh, it's a comedy club called the Pittsburgh Improv."
"Where's that?"
"I'm not sure. I mean, I'm still not sure. I rarely know the exact location of any comedy club in the nation. I just travel to these cities and know the name of the club. The club always arranges transportation for the headlining comic, so we really never know specifics unless we're very curious. Also, what if I did know the neighborhood? Would that actually mean something to Mike Tyson? Is he familiar with Pittsburgh's neighborhoods? "Hey, the club is in West Homestead, across from Somerset." Like now he's going to say,
"Oh, off 376 on the waterfront? Yeah, I love it there."
Then he asked what might be my favorite question of our whole interaction.
"Is your show tonight?"
He asked this as we were still on a plane, close to 11 p.m. Eastern time. What time would my show be? 2 in the morning? No, it's tomorrow.
Where?
The Pittsburgh Improv.
How do I find it?
This one left me frozen for a second. Mike's stare is an intense one. I watched him stare down his opponents before they fought so many times. Even from my living room, I could see the fear in their eyes. Now, here I was standing above him, and I could feel a hint of that stare. Suddenly, I'm Michael Spinks, and the worst moment of my life is about to happen. He had just asked me a question, and his expression said, "You'd better know the answer." I just blurted out whatever words popped into my head. "Well, if you Google my name, which is on the DVD, it'll bring up my calendar, and then you can see where I'm performing. That's probably the best way to find it." He thanked me, and I went back to my seat. I was breathing extra hard, and every ounce of me had been clearly suppressing how nervous I felt to engage him. But I did it. I was proud of myself. Just as my heart rate was coming down, I heard his unmistakable voice. "Tom." I turned, and Tyson was looking at me, casually twisting my DVD in his hands.
"Were you on television recently?"
I thought for a second, wishing the answer was yes, but knowing it was not. No. Mm-mm.
"Are you sure?"
"Yeah, I mean, yeah."
"Nothing?"
I thought for a second, and I just casually dropped, "I mean, I'm on Netflix."
"Hell yeah. I fucking love Netflix, man. What's your favorite show on Netflix, Tom?"
I tell him Breaking Bad, even though I know it's not a Netflix show. I'm nervous, and I also want him to think that what I watch is a solid choice. Without even hesitating, he goes,
"Yeah, my wife likes that."
I was gutted. Felt like he said,
"Some people like the ballet."
Then his eyes lit up.
"You like Sons of Anarchy?"
I was devastated. I've heard friends and critics rave about the show for years, but I'd never seen a single frame of it. It's just one of those things. There are only so many shows you can watch. Now I had the champ looking at me with boyish wonder in his eyes, and I had to say something. Do I disappoint him more? Of course not. "That's my favorite fucking show, man." Mike let out a maniacal laugh.
"I knew you with it. That's just wild."
He extended his fist, a fist that has ruined so many faces and nights for opponents. It sat there in the open space of the aisle, looking like a goddamn sledgehammer. I extended my little baby fist and gave him a bump. Awesome. This could not have gone any better. I not only met Mike, gave him my special, and had a friendly chat, but we had a real moment. Even though I lied, it was worth it. Now I was facing forward again and beaming, reliving the last 10 minutes of this flight over and over. I was anxious to land so I could call my friends. Just as my breathing returned to normal, I felt a strong grip on my left shoulder. It honestly felt like what I imagine a DEA agent's grasp would feel like when they finally got their hands on El Chapo. It had big, "stay right where you are" energy. I turned around expecting someone of authority to be looking over my shoulder, but it was Mike. His expression was nonchalant. This was simply a greeter's grasp to him, I guess. I had no idea what was going to happen. Tyson standing over you with his hand on your shoulder is a major alpha position. My eyes widened a bit, as did my mouth, and my asshole followed. Without warning, he leaned down to my left ear and gently whispered,
"I've been watching a lot of Netflix."
That's it. And he stood up and he was looking at me like, "It's your turn to talk." I stammered a bit, but managed to say, "Me too. Yeah, they have, man, so much stuff there. I don't even know what to watch."
"I recognize you."
He held up the DVD I had given him.
"This is the same picture that's on Netflix."
For a brief moment, I wasn't sure if he was fucking with me. He was showing me a picture of me that I had just given him and mentioning that it was on Netflix after I had just said that. but the look on his face was sincere, kind, and hopeful. Oh, yeah, that's the copy of that special.
I know who you are.
This was surreal, beyond surreal, actually. This larger-than-life figure who I grew up watching knock out grown men like he was in a video game was looking at me, telling me he knows me.
What's your phone number?
Mine? Rashad, the man who had been sitting next to Mike, pulled out his phone. I gave him my number.
We coming to your show tomorrow.
It was Mike's last statement to me before returning to his seat. Soon after, we landed and I hurried off the plane. It felt like the interaction had gone so well that any staying behind could only ruin it. I didn't want to overstay my welcome. On the way to the hotel, I called three friends and my father. I had to tell them. All of them responded with disbelief.
Kid Dynamite? You've made it, Tommy. Did he make you suck his dick?
That last one came from my friend Casey, not my father. The next morning, I woke up thinking it was a dream and knowing that, like a lot of celebs, many of whom I had encountered, I would never see him again. Sure, he said he wanted to come to the show, but everyone knows that is just something people say. And it's not limited to celebrities. Most of the time, it's non-celebs, if I'm being honest. People constantly ask when and where your shows are and make proclamations about how they definitely want to come and how they're trying to make it, as if it's meaningful to you, the performer, if they do or not. Little do they know, most comics not only don't care, they sometimes dread people they actually know coming to the show. If you go to your PDF and look at that photo of Mike Tyson in the airport, you can see that there's security around him, assistants around him, someone's holding up boxing gloves for him to sign. But if you zoom in, you can see that Mike Tyson is holding my DVD. That's not doctored. That's a real photo, and that is completely normal, the DVD that is in his hands. I decided to take a chance. I was going to tell the club to maybe expect Mike Tyson to come to the show. Why not? No one would know except the guy I was telling, and he was the manager of a comedy club, so fuck him. I called. I was nervous. I'm at the hotel, and yeah, all's good, for sure. Show's at 7. Okay. One other thing. Mike Tyson said he might come to the show tonight.
The fighter?
No, the guy who founded Tyson Chicken. Yeah, the fighter. The manager paused.
Holyfield too?
I don't think so. He told me if it happened, they'd take care of him. I wanted Mike to come, but more than that, I wanted him to come to a great show. Most shows are fine, even good. Some are terrible beyond belief. And then some are just magic. I was praying for one of those. But in comedy, like life, things don't ever go how you think they will. The afternoon felt like the longest one I could remember. I walked to a diner, paced around a mall, went to the gym, and stared at the ceiling in my hotel room. I couldn't believe how much the anticipation was fucking with me. I just wanted to know whether or not he'd really come to the show. Around 3:30 in the afternoon, my phone rang.
Tom, it's Mike Tyson. We're coming to your show tonight, brother.
Fucking, really?
Yeah, we want to watch you do your work.
I was genuinely excited. That's fucking crazy. He was gracious.
It's all love.
I'd heard the expression before. It's one I really enjoy. You're simply stating that the action you are taking is all about the best thing in the world. Love. In this case, brotherly love. I knew it was my turn to talk, and I wanted to say something that conveyed a similar message. I wanted to sound cool. I paused, and then I said it.
I love you.
Fuck. I shut my eyes so hard, I almost had a stroke. What am I doing? I just told Mike Tyson I love him. There was a pause on his end.
All right. Good luck tonight.
And the line went dead. Did I just ruin this? Was the former undefeated, undisputed heavyweight champion of the world about to come to my show, but changed his mind the moment I fell apart and professed my love to him? The house was half full. I started, and the first joke fell flat. I was distracted, looking around for the champ. I kept doing my set, and then it happened. I heard a loud slapping of the table. I squinted and saw Mike Tyson about three quarters of the way back in the room. The show ended up being fine. It was hard to concentrate because all I could think was, is Mike laughing at this? Am I bombing? Is he going to walk out? Luckily, I couldn't clearly see him, and I was finishing my set strong, but all I could think about was, what happens next with Mike? Do I acknowledge him and ask him to stand so 183 people can say, are you shitting me? Should I wave like a kid in a commercial to one of their sports idols? Luckily for me, I didn't have to think long. As I walked up the aisle, the audience was clapping and music played, and then I felt what I can only describe as what you might feel right before a polar bear tears your shoulder off. Mike had slapped my back.
Funny shit, Tom. Let's go to the green room.
I didn't even say a word. I just followed Mike to my green room. He led the way, of course. Once inside the small room, Mike and two of his crew got comfortable, and Mike began smoking cigarettes, one after the other. One thing that amazed me about this was how one of his guys would light Mike's cigs as he was putting it up to his lips. He didn't have to wait a beat. That was the first time in my life witnessing that level of submissiveness. I mean, it's beyond baller. It's a guy making sure you don't blink between cigarettes. Something I imagine Prince Alawid bin Talal would have done for him in one of his three Saudi palaces should the multi-billionaire investor decide to begin smoking. The conversation with Mike was epic. I'd love to put it all in this audiobook, but I would certainly fear for my safety and ability to choose solid foods if I divulged all the details. I can say that we talked life, boxing, and a lot of Mike's ups and downs. One of my favorite moments that I feel like I can share is how he viewed his role when stepping into the ring. He said it wasn't just about beating his opponent, but respecting that the audience wants to see a show. He was going for those knockouts, not just to win, but because he knew we wanted to see them. I loved it. He also went into detail about boxers he didn't think respected the audience and how boring they were to watch, and I will not be listing those names here. After about his fourth cigarette, he asked me, "You got a window in here?" I'm thinking, it's a little late for that. You've been puffing for an hour. I look around and tell him, "No, no window." And like something straight out of a movie, he took a long drag off his smoke and said, "That's when you'll know you've made it, when your green room has a window." I've never heard it put that way or thought about it, but it registered right away. It also felt like someone clearly telling me, "You definitely have not made it yet." Mike smoked a few more cigs, then said he was going to turn in. A few hours had passed, and when I opened the door to walk him out, the entire staff of the club was lined up. They all wanted pics, and Mike obliged. If this story sounds familiar to you, it's because you heard the stage version, one that I started telling the next day. It killed immediately. Eventually, it became my closing bit on the new hour I was working on. You can see the stand-up version of it on my 2016 Netflix special, Mostly Stories. I also ended up telling it on talk shows and podcasts as it was a fan favorite. One random afternoon a few years later, I got a call from Joe Rogan. He told me to come by his studio in about an hour. When I walked in, I saw a group of people sitting in one of Joe's green rooms. I made my way through the small gathering to see who was on the couch. It was Mike Tyson holding court. He looked up at me.
"Man, you know people stop me all the time asking me if that shit is true. I say, yeah, man, all that happened."
"Me too." He got up and gave me a hug, and I thought, what a cool moment. I thanked Joe, and then Joe really surprised me. He leaned in and said in my ear, "Why don't you stay and podcast with us?" My heart almost stopped. Not only was I floored at the offer, but I was torn as well. This happened to be the day that I was supposed to be meeting up with my wife at a nearby hotel to celebrate our anniversary. I didn't know what to say. What I felt was that even though sitting in on the podcast with Mike Tyson seemed like the coolest thing in the world, Something about it made me feel like I shouldn't put it over my wife, especially on our anniversary. It felt like the right thing to do was leave. I didn't want to make that call. Hey, I'm podcasting for a while, so see you later. I told him I could stay for a little bit, but we got started and the podcast was awesome. I got to ask him something I had never remembered to ask when we hung out, which was, what made you think you could get a tiger? The answer was better than anything you could make up. Mike told a story about ordering his first wildcat from prison. He was on the phone with his car broker, and the broker happened to mention that he could also get wild animals. So naturally, Mike said, can I get a tiger? And his car broker told him, no problem. Mike Tyson basically got a tiger because his car guy was out of Bentleys. The energy was flowing so well on this podcast, but I kept looking at the time. I needed to make a decision, stay and have a good talk or leave. I was feeling anxious and told the two of them, I gotta go. And it was Mike who was pleading with me to stay. Come on, man, don't go. Surreal. Iron Mike telling me to stay because he was having fun. I had to. Wife, you know? They both nodded. I left Joe's studio and had to pause. Damn, that would have been so cool to stay. I took the 405 over the hill to the Beverly Hills Hotel. I arrived a few minutes before my wife and took her to their famous eatery, the Polo Lounge, for lunch. I tried to talk about anything else, but I couldn't stop thinking about what had just happened. You're not going to believe it. I was just podcasting with Joe and Mike Tyson. So unreal. But you know what? I left so I could be here with you. Why didn't you stay? Isn't it obvious? Hello? I didn't want you to feel bad that I had made that a priority over meeting up on our anniversary. Clearly, there are big-time husband points to be had here. I stopped doing what I wanted to do because I was putting her first. Isn't that what every wife wants? For their husband to stop enjoying himself so he can have lunch with her? Oh, I would have stayed. What? We had plans to be here now. Yeah, but it's Mike Tyson. God fucking damn it. If you go to the PDF, you can see Mike Tyson and I standing outside the green room after a couple hours of him smoking a bunch of cigarettes and us having a great chat. Pulitzer Prize submission. Wow, what a ride, huh? There's good literature, and then there's what you just finished listening to. Hopefully, you have the confidence that you can make a pipe bomb in under an hour and without incriminating yourself. I mean, that was the goal of this writing. No, I'm just goofing around. I do feel like you probably have a better understanding of paleomagnetism and the conflict in Gaza. I'm able to see these complicated situations and make them easy to digest for you, the listener. But seriously, I am extremely thankful to you for purchasing or stealing this audiobook and listening to it. If you didn't listen to it and just skipped ahead to this part of the book, well, I commend you for your inability to start things. Hopefully, you laughed throughout, or maybe even a few times. It'd be weird if you only laughed once. But still, that's better than not laughing at all. If you did buy this audiobook and you listened to the whole thing and you never even let out a sound, I feel like you might have some sort of undiagnosed personality disorder. Check out the DSM and see what feels most like you. I'm going to dinner now, but it's going to be a sensible portion so I don't get all super fat like my dear friend Bert. This has been a Hachette Audio production of I'd Like to Play Alone, Please, Essays. Written and read by me, Tom Segura. Produced and directed by Elise Green. Recorded by Sarah Nil and Chad Wallin at YMH Studios. Post-production by Gabino Reyes. I'd Like to Play Alone, Please is also available in print and digital formats from Grand Central Publishing, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette Audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2022 by Tom Segura. Audio production copyright 2022, Hachette Audio, all rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this book without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the book other than for review purposes, please contact permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights.
I mean, Tommy, multiple choice, two questions.
You sound... Are you okay?
I feel so funny. I can't believe I'm laughing this hard.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.